Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Thank you for joining us on the Wise Women Media, the radio show. And we are going to have our first hour with Cindy Sheehan, our second hour with Robin Ledoux. But before we get started, I just wanted to tell people, remind them where they can find us on the net. We are at wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com. On the website, you can find archives to all of our shows, complete show descriptions, links to our social networks, ways to get in touch with us, also a GoFundMe link. This is independent media, so we are not corporate sponsored or funded, and any little bit that you can throw our way at the GoFundMe link is greatly appreciated and helps us stay on the air every week. I want to give a shout out especially to the Common Project Network and Here Be Monsters on Blog Talk Radio. That gives us this time slot every week so we can do the show. So I wanted to give a little background about Cindy Sheehan for those of you that may be listening that may not know anything about her, which I would find that quite surprising in the progressive community. Cindy Sheehan was the mother of Specialist Casey Sheehan, who was killed in Iraq on April 4, 2004, in USA's illegal and immoral occupation for profit. Cindy was a liberal Democrat before Casey was killed, but of course she went on a quest to find out why her son was killed and why the people that were responsible for his death were not held accountable. The first time I met Cindy was when Code Pink came here right before the 2004 elections. So it was October of 2004 when she came to visit the St. Pete, Tampa area, and we had quite a direct action that took place while Bush was having dinner with a very wealthy donor on Snell Island in St. Pete. Since then, Cindy has traveled around the world. She's represented peace, social justice, human rights. She's written a number of different works. She has campaigned for governor, Congress, and Vice President of the United States. So she's been there and done it all. So I think she's on the line. Hi, Cindy, is that you?
It is, Anita. Hello.
Hi, thank you for joining us tonight. Greatly appreciate you being able to find time out of your busy schedule to join us. Unfortunately, it's just such a sad time for us in the peace community, as the news has just gotten so out of control, I think. That's the only term I can give it. Let's talk a little bit about that, and, well, let's start with what you're doing now, since you give us a rundown on what happened when you were running for governor and how that ended up for those people that do not know.
Okay, thank you, Anita, and thanks for inviting me. It's nice to be on your show again. So, as you said, in 2012, I ran for vice president with the Peace and Freedom Party. I've been a member of the Peace and Freedom Party since 2009. So I ran against Pelosi in the elections of 2008. That was in November. I think it was about January of 2009. I realized that I was a socialist, so I joined the only socialist party in California that has ballot access, and that's the Peace and Freedom Party. And in about 2010, I got the germ of an idea to run against Jerry Brown for governor, because Jerry Brown, of course, is devoted to the prison industrial complex, to big oil. He's solved the deficit in California by what he said was balancing the budget off the backs of those that are already vulnerable. And he said that like there was nothing wrong with it, that the vulnerable should pay and not the 700,000 millionaire plus households in California. So it's a very wealthy state, but we have 25% of our population living in poverty, and that's the federal poverty level, which is already super low anyway. And so I got the idea to run against him, and in 2012 I was asked by Roseanne Barr and the Peace and Freedom Party to be her running mate, because she wanted to get the Peace and Freedom Party nomination. And then I told them that if that happened, then I would really want the party to back me for governor in 2014. And it was, I want to tell you, Anita, it was like the most boring, energyless campaign I've ever been on. There were 15 people running for governor in an open primary. In California, we don't have party primaries anymore. We have something that's called a jungle primary, where every candidate, regardless of party affiliation or if they're independent, they run in the June primary, and only the top two vote-getters move on to the general election. And since that law has been in place since 2010, it's always been like a Democrat and a Republican, or two Democrats or two Republicans vying for these offices. So it's a very anti-democratic law. So now in June, out of 15 candidates, I came in seventh, and the top two vote-getters were Jerry Brown, a Democrat who acts very much like a Republican, and Neil Kashkari, a Republican who acts like a Republican, but he admits to voting for Obama, and he was Obama's manager of the Troubled Assets Relief Program, and he's a former executive of Goldman Sachs. So since Jerry Brown's so devoted to fracking, I call him Jerry Fracky and the other guy Goldman Sacky. So it's Fracky versus Sacky.
That's great.
So what happens, as always, the establishment wins, and
yeah,
bankers win and big oil wins, or the prisons win, and we the people lose. No matter who's victorious in November, we the people are going to lose. And this isn't a tale that is, unfortunately, limited to California. It's just nationwide, where the establishment, the 1%, whatever you want to call them, the status quo is literally taking over, and we the people are being crowded into a smaller and smaller and smaller piece of the pie.
Well, we have Scott here in Florida, so I had to make that comment, you know, and we've had to deal with a horrible situation here in Florida with Scott as governor, and of course he's got the money to put himself back, you know, in office in November. He's going to run the reelection campaign, and he's going to probably win because he's going to have more money than anybody else. So it's come down to whoever can pay the most gets to play.
Mm-hmm.
And what is your take now on anybody that is aspiring to run for office, even if it's at the local level? Do you think that the game is sewn up? Do you think the game is over?
I would say that, yes, it is, if you're looking at statewide or nationwide offices. I think our best bet would be to concentrate on boards of supervisors. I mean, when I say we, I mean people who are outside of the so-called two-party system, concentrate on those boards of supervisors, boards of education, city council, your office, things like that. I think that the Peace and Freedom Party, the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, I think we all make mistakes about trying to do it top-down. I think we need
right.
to do it more horizontal, bottom-up situation if we ever want to have a political party. And, you know, Thomas Jefferson, you know me, I'm not a member of the cult of the founders or the cult of the Constitution, but Thomas Jefferson said the government that has the most power over you should be the one closest to you, not the one farthest away from you. If we get on our even condo boards, you know, build that kind of community, then it should spread up instead of constantly trying to break in to an arena that is 100% rigged against us.
Right. I agree. I'm done, actually, with the Hillsborough County Soil and Water Board in January. And, of course, since I've moved counties, I won't be able to run again to be reelected to that board. But there
mm-hmm.
are observers to that board, so I'm considering doing that position and possibly running for something in Hernando. But, you know, I'm kind of just leaving that to the wind at this point. Another question that I think a lot of people might have, because we hear so much from other people, and it's especially coming out of Fox News, and it's spewing out of the mouths of the extremely conservative people, Obama's socialist, or you're socialist, or this is socialist, or that is socialist. Why does everybody give socialism a bad rap? And why should they not give it a bad rap?
Well, I wish Obama was a socialist. That's what I have to say about that. But
right.
Of course, Anita, this country is founded on capitalism and profit and genocide and slavery. So when an alternative to that came around, and you can even say the alternative was the progressive movement at the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, things like that, and socialism or communism was a more viable alternative to, and people were grasping for that. You know, desperately poor people were looking for political power and for a bigger piece of the pie. And so, of course, there's a huge demonization campaign against socialism and communism, and there were witch hunts, and I think the propaganda campaign against communist countries, socialist countries, socialist leaders has been very effective, especially during the Cold War when we were growing up. You know, we were afraid of there was a red under our bed, and so I often joke. There were two things when I was growing up that I was afraid of, the red communist and the Holy Ghost. And, of course, those were just both fear tactics. But then also the thing is people, it's easy to do this to America because we don't travel. We don't go around the world. We don't speak different languages. We don't want to go see for ourselves what's happening. And since my son was killed, I've been to Cuba 5 or 6 times. And, of course, the first time I went, I was nervous because I had been conditioned to think that, you know, Cuba was an evil place. And now, of course, I know the exact opposite about Cuba. The only reason our government doesn't want us to go there is because they don't want us to see how wonderful the system is. Cuba, of course, has health care for all. They have education up to university for free. Housing is a right, not a privilege. There's no homeless people in Cuba, and they might not all have mansions, but they all have a dry roof over their heads and food in their bellies. And so, you know, it was just a very effective propaganda campaign. And when I wrote Myth America, the 20 Greatest Myths of the Robber Class and the Case for Revolution, and I saw you down in Florida when I was on that book tour, the thing is about capitalism and the system we have now is another myth that we're conditioned that if we're good enough and if we keep our nose clean and if we work hard and obey all the rules, don't rock the boat, worship wealth, then we're going to climb up into the 1%. That it's the American dream. And, of course, that is a huge myth. And so we don't want to rock that boat because we want to be like that. And when I was campaigning for governor, and I would talk to people, and I would say 25% of the people that you live in the state with live below the federal poverty line. And it's only going to change when the 75% of people who don't recognize that and care about it and, you know, are willing to give up some of their piece of the pie to help those people. So it's just a horrible, you know, ignorance is just rife in this country about everything. It's rife about Israel. You know, we're supposed to believe that Israel is the victim. And I would dare to say that most people in this country believe that.
And that has been an incredible propaganda campaign ever since I was working in military intelligence in the early 80s. And I was stationed in Athens, Greece, and I supported a reconnaissance mission in the Eastern Mediterranean. So I was very, very close to the situations, you know, the whole Middle East situation at that time, and of course reading TSSCI classified information about it, and briefing and debriefing these air crews that were leaving every morning at 0:30. So, you know, not much has changed, but there was, you know, we were strongly supporting Israel's position no matter what. And, of course, coming into the peace community much later when I grew up, I was able to see how this was all, you know, everybody else was getting a different story. Everybody else through the media, through the mainstream media, was getting a different story than what I was getting. And I could see that we were supporting the wrong side. And, you know, as a country, we were supposed to be not like the Soviet Union, because I was still military during the Cold War. The Cold War still existed. And now I see that we've become more like the old Soviet Union every single day. We've become closer and closer to that. And how much of that was propaganda is the question I have to ask, too. So we have so much happening on so many fronts. We have Afghanistan. Now we have Iraq again. We have what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in Syria, now Libya. It's like, and it's almost like all this has been created. Do you have anything to say to that? What do you think would be the reason?
Well, gosh, about about Israel and all of the chaos happening around the world today. So, of course, we, the United States, I don't even want to say we because it's not me. I don't support Israel. I don't pay my taxes. I'm a war tax resister, and I think you are too. And we, of course, I can't say we. So the U.S. Supports Israel with billions of dollars every year, while, like you said, this country's economy and infrastructure is going into the toilet. Of course, $3 billion, whatever, billions of dollars isn't a lot of money, but we could, I mean, it's a huge amount of money, but relatively speaking, it's not that much money, but we could definitely use that here in the United States. But I went over to Jordan back in 2006, I think. And we met with many Jordanian officials, and some people came from Iraq to meet with us because we couldn't go to Iraq, so they went to Amman to meet with us. But I met this man who was like the minister of agriculture in Jordan. He wasn't at the time, but he was previously. And he explained to me that it's a what everybody in the Middle East knows, even Israel, is that the Israeli-U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East is to divide every country there. So look at what happened to Iraq. We took a basically unified country that really unified even more under the sanctions, that because they were, we imposed crippling sanctions against them, and so they unified even more. I have so many friends and contacts from Iraq or in Iraq that say, you know, before 2003, we were married to each other. Sunni married Shia and Christian, and there was like none of this division. But after the occupation, of course, there was a lot of division. Look what happened in Libya. Look what's happening in Syria. And this man told me that this plan was because it's called the Lebanonization of the Middle East, because it divides the stronger nation states into little tribal divisions that aren't so strong in opposition to Israel. And this is to make Israel more secure in the Middle East.
Right. It's from what I understand, it's $3.5 billion that we give them, and that is not including military armament and hardware. So we're providing a lot more than that $3.5 billion. And
right.
more and more people are talking to me about the BDS movement, the boycotts, divestments, and sanctions. What do you think about that? Have you done any research on that yourself?
First of all, about the money we give Israel, I think that the Congress just appropriated more money, too, to increase their Iron Dome. And
right.
I call it the Iron Boondoggle.
Yeah, $225 million. But this is, a lot of people are saying that, you know, they're merely testing our weapons. And, you know, I can't help but think, since they're testing the weapons on the Palestinians, which are their nearest neighbors, mm-hmm. that they're probably going to go and hit Iraq with them later, now that they know that they work, these weapons work.
Right.
So
right.
I'm just advising that. And then, of course, I'm starting to think, after Iraq, what happens next? Will it be us? Will it be another country in the Middle East? You know, it's hard to say. But that's an awful lot of money in the, you know,
right.
the BDS movement is one way where we can put a stranglehold on them, basically. So.
Well, I know that that the BDS movement was successful in one of the things in ending South African apartheid, for sure. And I think that we should, if we care about peace and if we care about justice, then we should be boycotting any product that comes from Israel. But especially if the companies have factories or plants in the occupied territories. So I think that it's very effective. I look through the BDS list, and there's not really anything I'd buy anyway. Today, you know, I found out that Volvo, we shouldn't buy Volvo, and I was like, oh, I guess I can't go purchase that new Volvo I was going to purchase tomorrow. But you know, I think that we have so little power. One of our powers that we do have is the power of where we spend our money.
Exactly. That's about all we have left.
Isn't it any product with a code of 729 that starts with 729 comes from Israel?
Yes, that's what I've been hearing, but I'm also hearing, and I'm not sure whether it's, you know, rumors that those UPC codes are going to be changed. I don't know how true that is. I don't know if that's already happened, but something extremely bizarre was I had downloaded an app on my phone called Buycott, B-U-Y-C-O-T-T. For our listeners, it's still in Google Play, but I had it on my phone, and it would work every now and then, but it was really weird when I went into the store. I could scan one item, and then it wouldn't work for any other, and then it would say, you know, this application is shut down, and or this application has turned off or whatever. It said something like that. And even when I would restart my phone, I'd try to scan a product again, and the app would still go down. But the other day I picked up just something very similar, you know, very simple. I think it was a jar of, you know, one of those refrigerated dressings like Marie's or something like that. It was just a jar of ranch dressing. And I scanned it, and it said, this UPC code doesn't match this product, and this name doesn't match this product. And I went, ooh, that's freaky. And I put the item back. I thought, you know what? If I don't know where it comes from, I'm not buying it. You know,
Absolutely.
You know, and I think that that's probably a good rule of thumb for anybody that really wants to make a difference. If you don't know where it comes from, if you can't vouch for the fact that that's not made or produced in an Israeli settlement or in Israel, then don't buy it. I think what's really going to hurt a lot of people is Coke and Starbucks are two of the big companies that are on that list. Can you think of any others?
Well, two things, places I don't go anyway. I also see that the UPC code that starts with 871 So it's 871 and 729 that are made in Israel. Yeah, SodaStream is a big one. They sell them at Target, at Costco, and I was just looking at a list today. So let me find it. You talk while I try and find that list.
Well, I'm actually typing this up in Twitter, but you know,
McDonald's.
I'm sorry?
McDonald's. You don't want to go
to
McDonald's.
Oh, McDonald's. Oh, yeah. McDonald's is a big one. Most of the fast food, really, is on that list. Quite a bit of them. But I even got several Twitter wars with some of these people that I guess have been paid off by the IDF $2,000 to just hang out online and harass people.
Right.
So earlier today, I was called Hamas. somebody called me Hamas, and I told him he was a liar, and he was such a liar his nose was across the street. And then I hashtagged Pinocchio, and he was like really insulted. But you know, I've been having kind of like Twitter wars, but fun ones to kind of dodge these people who are really trying to hang out on Twitter and really direct the conversation and try to input the disinformation. And that's happening on Twitter a lot. So I would caution anybody out there, if you don't know how to troll people, you probably don't want to do it, because these people are pretty vicious. And I'm beginning to think that they know who some of us are, too. But another thing that's been very scary today is the fact that normally I can see what's going on through live feeds, and none of those live feeds are up now. The live feeds haven't been up for about 48 hours now. So that's really scary. So none of us really know what's going on there. It's like, radio silence, and it's all dark as far as broadcasting goes. So what do we do next with this BDS movement? How can we tell people, how can we educate people that this is the only thing we can do? How can we spread the word?
Well, I think that the best way at this point is through social media. I know that in Sacramento, there's a group of Dinian supporters who regularly go to stores, and they hold up signs if they sell like SodaStream or Motorola products. We're supposed to boycott them. Ahava skincare products.
Right.
They go to these stores and that sell the products, and they have little demos and they pass out literature, because not everybody, of course, is as informed as we are. And most people use Twitter and Facebook for personal, family, or friend stuff. And, of course, I use it and you use it for political stuff like this to spread the word. So, I mean, going to one of those stores like Walmart with signs and flyers is brilliant, because, most of the people going in there have no idea about this stuff. And it might start them to think that, maybe Israel's not the victim.
Right. And the victims clearly are the children. And this is what a lot of people also don't know, is that 50% of the, the people in Gaza, I'm not sure about the West Bank, but for Gaza for sure, 50% of them are children under 18. And I just thought, wow, those numbers are so incredibly high for how many young people are living in that country. So they didn't vote for Hamas. It was not a majority vote. And who are Hamas? Are they a handful of extremists? Can anybody prove that they're firing rockets? What do you think about that? Because I don't think they're firing rockets. They don't have an air force. an army or a navy. So, you know, Israel is,
right.
has perpetuated, oh, Hamas is firing rockets at us. But there's no proof of that.
Well, of course there's no proof. And extremists, Zionist extremists, will say that that it's bad for the Palestinians, it's bad for Hamas or whomever to make Israel kill children. And was it Golda Meir that said, we don't hate the Palestinians? I'm paraphrasing. We don't hate the Palestinians so much for killing us, but for making us kill them.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that. I could not wrap my mind around that.
Yeah, people have actually defended Israel's slaughtering of these people in Gaza who have nowhere to go. And like you said, they have no army, they have no navy, they have no air force, they have nowhere to go. And so they're blaming the real victims for the slaughter. And they say that it's Hamas's fault because they're firing rockets from schools. They're firing rockets from UN refuges and places places like that. And so Hamas, there's a lot of evidence out there that Hamas, of course, was created by Israel. And I don't know if so much created, but as the Palestinian Authority, as the PLO, have they're using Hamas as an excuse to bombard Gaza. And
right.
at first, I believe that Hamas was a legitimate political elected entity in Gaza because the people were looking for something to get them out of this from behind the wall, from the blockade, from the the terrible conditions that they lived under. So like it's really nebulous, and ISIS in Iraq is very nebulous. My sister and I spent all day yesterday researching to see who the hell is ISIS all of a sudden.
And were you able to find anything out about them?
Well, there's a lot of evidence, of course, that like the Mujahideen, like Al-Qaeda, they were been funded by the CIA.
Well, Cynthia McKinney has said that several times, you know, that these different groups are just CIA's Rolodex. So, you know, they even said Bin Laden was, you know, his code name was Tim Osman, that he was really,
right.
you know, a CIA asset. So, you know, many of us
course,
that have
yeah.
been around for a long time in the intelligence community, when I was in there, you know, Russia was fighting against Afghanistan, and we were helping Afghanistan at that time against
right.
Soviet Union. It wasn't Russia
Absolutely.
At the time. And supposedly Tim Osman / Bin Laden was working for the other side and was considered a freedom fighter. And I never heard those terms, Al-Qaeda. I've heard of Mujahideen, but I had never heard of Al-Qaeda or ISIS or any of these other groups. They did not exist. So I know for a fact they were created, or they may have come into formation after I got out of the service when I no longer had access classified. But back in 81 to 85, they did not exist. So anybody who says they did, they're lying.
Right.
So it's that simple.
Well,
and none of that's classified now. It's been way over 20 years, so anything I say is not even a threat to anybody anymore. But I'm just quite appalled at how all of this has changed. And now we're back in Iraq again. So what do you think of that?
Well, first of all, contrary to popular belief, we never left Iraq. And we never, all the troops were never fully withdrawn from Iraq. We still have an embassy there the size of something like 25 football fields. And we employ thousands of people at the embassy and at the consulate in Basra. So we've never even really left there. And, of course, the mercenary killers never left either. And it's interesting that Nouri al-Maliki is the puppet government of, you know, he's a puppet ruler of the U.S., and now the U.S. is sometimes calling for his resignation. They want to replace him or whatever. But I had Dahlia Wasfi on Cindy Sheehan's soapbox maybe about 6 weeks ago. And, of course, she's from Iraq. She has family in Iraq. And she says a lot of the trouble there and, you know, a lot of the violence is caused from legitimate resistance to the puppet government that the U.S. installed and to the U.S., that it's still there.
Right.
And, of course, the U.S. propaganda machine doesn't want us to know that. So this ISIS, whatever it is, of course, is a very convenient entity to demonize. And so, and it's hard to find any credible information because I'm not going to believe anything that CNN says about it or, you know, the propaganda media, but it's hard to find some independent sources to confirm exactly what's going on in Iraq and who this ISIS is. Do they have support of the citizens or whatever? But just know that a lot of it is legitimate resistance to the occupation that still continues. And earlier you said something about the world's in chaos, what's going on. And, of course, we're backing in Syria so-called al-Qaeda and extremists that are trying to overthrow the Assad government. In the Ukraine, the U.S., I said we, I don't want to say that. The U.S. is backing neo-Nazis, extremists that overthrew a legitimate government. And then all of this through one of my favorite countries, Venezuela, and the U.S. trying to overthrow Venezuela, the Venezuelan legitimately elected government. That kind of all fell onto the back burner. So it's just, and then we have all these Democrats who will, like, support Obama until a nuclear bomb falls on their head. And they'll probably support him up until the last second. Like, where
is
Obama?
Well, that's even more shocking is they're going to support Hillary. That's what's shocking to me. Because,
right.
I mean, you're laughing and I'm laughing, but I'm just saying in 2016, you know, I don't know who can run against her and beat her. So we're looking at, you know, another 4 to 8 years of more of the same war, endless war. That's what it is. It's going to be 4 to 8 years more of this. And the Democrats are just, oh, la-di-da-di. We have to vote for her because if we don't, then a Republican will get in.
And then
we'll have four to eight years of war.
You know? Then there'll be 4 to 8 years of war. Doesn't matter who gets in president. We're going to just have continual, constant war. And so that is very shocking that these people, can you imagine if Mitt Romney were president or McCain were president and the same kind of stuff was going on? Can you imagine the hemorrhaging that these Democrats would be having at this point?
Oh, people would be in the streets, wouldn't they?
Yeah,
they'd be in the streets
24/7,
just like all of us were in 2004. Remember that? We were all in the streets. The anti-war movement had swelled. It was huge, I think. At one point, there was a march in Rome, 3 million people in one march.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
It was just huge all over the world, but especially here. And then all of a sudden, you know, he gets reelected, and we have four more years of war after that, and then, oh, Obama, you know, made all the promises. You know, I'm going to take all the,
right.
you know, all the prisoners out of Guantanamo. I'm going to bring all the troops home from Iraq. I'm going to do that, and Afghanistan too. And look at where we at. We're at a worse place almost 7 years later. We're at a worse place than we ever have been. And the Democrats, you know, just, okay, let's vote for Hillary. Are you ready for Hillary? Come on. So it's just freaking me out.
And Obama has, of course, dramatically increased the use of unmanned aerial vehicles. And so the people who didn't care about the wars before care about them even less now, because American citizens aren't being bombed, aren't being killed. I'm sorry. The troops aren't being killed as much as they had been before. So it's just really just like global chaos and war and oppression. The White House said, like a couple weeks ago, the White House said that this administration has been a force for good so many places around the world.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
You know, the drones, there was a big story here in our Tampa Bay Times about the drones. I think it was two Sundays ago. And they're already being used by the real estate companies. And I remember probably about 6 months ago, I went with actually the man who ran for president under the Socialist Party ticket, Brian Moore, who lives in Spring Hill, Florida. He was at the same county commissioner meeting where there was many of us that went to the county commissioner meeting talking about drones having a staging place at the Hernando County Airport for drones.
Mm-hmm.
So we all went and spoke, and we were all against it. But then, you know, here we are 6 to 9 months later, and they're writing an article in the paper about drones routinely being used by real estate companies. And
right.
The same week, I was at my landlord's, and we were just having a chat, and she said, you know, Anita, she said, and she tries to stay out of politics as much as she can, but she said, you know, she said, there was one that flew right over me. She said it was... Last week, she said it was like a helicopter with no outside of it, with no fuselage
mm-hmm.
on it.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, and it flew right over this property. And she said, and I heard it before I saw it. So, you know, they're routinely using them, and you know, the people should be outraged. They should be furious. You know, I mean. If they can pinpoint your speed, here in Florida, they also have what's called stingrays. These are devices that they can point at your car as you're driving by, and it bounces off your cell phone, and they don't even have to run your tag. They know who you are driving the vehicle. It may be your vehicle, it may be someone else's, but they did it to me. They'll come right up to the car before they even run your tag, and they told me, oh, Anita Stewart? And you know, they had bounced it. There was no way they could have run my tag. They were not behind me but seconds. And that's just bizarre. But that's on the ACLU website, and Democracy Now! has had a bit on the show about it. So our privacy has been so invaded that, you know, I keep wondering, are we next? Are we next for the bombing? We're definitely next for the third world status.
Right.
Do you have anything to say about third world status? And I mean, you've been to Venezuela. You've been to other places. Tell me where you think we're at in regards to third world status compared to other countries.
Well, first of all, about drones also, I just read an article where what's her name? Martha Stewart got a drone for her birthday. And so she can fly above her estates and take pictures and, she's just like, just think of who, whatever the person's name was that designed Versailles in France, just think if he had a drone, how wonderful it would be, you know, and that's like just getting ridiculous. Of course, the United States has the widest income disparity of any country, any so-called first world country. So the only thing between us and, like, Venezuela that has pretty high standard of living, really, it's a poor country, but, of course, they have health care, dental care, education as human rights. The government spends a lot of their oil wealth, which I don't like. I don't like an oil-based economy there any more than I like it here. But they spend it on the people, not the corporations don't get as much as their profits. I was just reading today that the Walton family has more wealth than, like, 41% of the rest of the United States put together. That's what I'm talking about, a smaller and smaller piece of the pie. And in the United States, most people that have creature comforts, that have a house, a roof over their head, that have a car, that have a TV in every room, they don't own those things. You know, they purchase them on credit, and that's what allows the 1% and the bankers and Wall Street to get even wealthier. And so we have an appearance of prosperity when I know realistically that most people are struggling. And to me and to most people that analyze these things and look at it very closely, the United States is in the end days of empire. We're on the verge of collapse. And it looks like everything that the 1% is doing is trying to forestall that for as long as they can. And it's not to help us, of course, because they're getting richer and richer and richer and richer, and we're getting poorer and poorer and poorer and poorer. So they don't want it to collapse because they don't want their little empires within the empires to collapse also. So, of course, I say that as activists, as anti-empire activists, everything we do every day should be to hasten the collapse of this empire so we won't be such a global force for evil around the world. And it'll be tough, it'll be hard, and that's why we need to build these communities and need to be working locally so we can protect ourselves and our communities and our families from the inevitable collapse of the empire. I'm not sitting here like with a crystal ball. I'm sitting here with the knowledge of thousands of years of history to see that no empire, especially when it is devoting most of its resources and wealth to expanding that empire into wars, can last forever. It has to collapse.
And I would say I agree with all of that, and I would say in regards to the problem of Gaza, since I've been watching that more closely than everything else, they need to just lift the siege and end the blockade and you know, allow things to go back to normal. But, you know, unfortunately, we're the ones paying for that, and that's where our money goes. So that's why the little people, we're, you know, everything around our economy is collapsing. So, but anyway, we're getting close to the end of our time. Tell us a little bit about the radio show and where people can find you online.
Okay, thank you. And I just want to say something about the Palestinians, too. The ones that I associate with say, we don't want ceasefires, we want freedom. And
right.
So I think ceasefires are good because then people aren't getting slaughtered. But it seems like the ceasefires never lead to those talks.
Right.
They never lead to the solution that gives Palestinians the right of return, at least compromise to the 1967 borders. I'm a hardliner. I say let's go to the pre-1947 borders. let's give Palestinians the right to return and give them back their state named Palestine. So anyway, thank you. I have my own podcast. It's called Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, and I have a website, cindysheehansoapbox.com, that has all of the articles about current events. Of course, we focus on empire and things like that are happening around the world. And people can email me at cindysheehansoapbox@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter and I'm on Facebook. We have Cindy Sheehan Soapbox Radio Show Facebook page. And on Twitter, I'm Cindy Sheehan Paz, P-A-Z.
Thank you so much for being on the show tonight. I greatly appreciate it. And this show is available for archive, so, you know, just use the same link and anybody can listen to the show at any time. And would love to have you back again. So I can't remember when I last interviewed you. I'd have to go back into the archives. But usually I think lately I've been having you on about every 6 months or so. So that's usually a good update for everybody. But thank you so much, and have a great rest of the weekend.
Well, thank you, Anita. You too. And thank you for having me on again. And thank you for having this show and everything you do.
All right. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. So that was Cindy Sheehan. Again, the archive for that show is available at wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com. I'm going to play a song right now, and then we'll do the pre-recorded interview with Robin Ledoux. She is an amazing person. I'll tell you a little bit about her bio after the song, and then I'll start the recorded interview. This is Higher Ground by Playing for Change. The first song at the top of the show was another Playing for Change song, and it was a remake of Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. This one is Higher Ground by Stevie Wonder. Playing for Change's cover of that. Enjoy. Thank you. that was Playing for Change doing Stevie Wonder's song Higher Ground. A little bit about Robin Ledoux. Dr. Robin Ledoux is a retired clinical psychologist, formerly in private practice in Washington. She has worked with so many. She's been affiliated with the University of Missouri, Kansas City, University of Washington Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, and the Native American Center of Excellence. She's the award-winning author of Journey Through the Healing Circle books and video. One of her latest offerings is called September Totems. Dr. Ledoux has lectured worldwide on the effects of prenatal exposure and historical trauma in the Native American communities, as well as the consequences of and treatment for psychological trauma, including traditional Native methods of treatment. She is an enrolled member of the Cowlitz Indian Tribe of Washington State. So check out on Amazon and elsewhere on the net, September Totems. And I'm going to start the interview, which we pre-recorded last night, as there was a raging wildfire about a mile from her home. But we were able to get the interview in. I haven't heard from her today, and I'm hoping she's okay. So here we go.
Thank you for joining us, Robin, and give us a little heads up on what you've been doing since I interviewed you last, which I think was last April, and then we can start talking about peace and how to get there. So what have you been up to?
I can't believe it's been 4 months. Amazing. Well, in the last 4 months, I've been working on getting my book out, and I've started a book of poetry on being Native in this country as well as just being a woman in this country and, you know, being a 60-year-old woman in a country where I'm no longer considered youthful by any stretch of the imagination. So I've been doing that, and as I said right now, we're watching, unfortunately, the wildfires burn around the area where I live, and I've got one just a few miles south of me right now. We've been struggling with that for about a month now. Other than that, kind of enjoying being retired and working on a new historical novel.
And tell us a little bit about the novel, if you can, without revealing too much.
I'll be happy to. This one is about a woman who's Métis, but she's mixed blood from Canada, but also enrolled with the Crow people. And many people don't know the story of the Crows and people in other tribes and what happened with the U.S. cavalry. So the book addresses that, but it's about a woman who, of course, falls for the wrong man. Both her husband and her lover are non-Native, they're white, and it's about her own emotional annihilation, set against the backdrop of the annihilation of the Métis people, the Saguenay people, and Chief Joseph, the Nez Perce people, because the lover has an Appaloosa horse, and she starts to tell them the story of the horse, which, of course, was nearly eradicated when the U.S. government came to eradicate Chief Joseph. So it's basically two tracks. One is the near eradication of the Native people of this country, the Crow people who were not eradicated, and the history behind that. And the second track is this woman's own emotional devastation, annihilation, her nativeness being annihilated by the white man that she falls in love with. It's a little bit interesting in that I don't know if you know this, that a great majority of Native women marry outside Native men. A very significant portion, which is so unfortunate because we're losing our I'm sorry, my cat here is ready to join us. We're losing so much of our culture. And in my own life, my first husband was Osage, but my second husband is Caucasian. So it's really detailing, you know, how our people have survived through our quality. What it's like to be Native in the same age, particularly as I mentioned, as I was reading today, I'm thinking, that man seriously needs to get on some antipsychotic medication, because I think his delusions have just gotten the better of him. So
yeah, for those of you that are listening that don't know what happened, Ted Nugent, of course, is racist among many other things, but he tends to open his mouth and say things that are extremely demeaning to other people. And if anybody wants the details of that, they can just Google Ted Nugent and read read a little bit about what he's been up to and what he's been saying. But we won't focus on that here. Let me ask you this, Robin. Do you think it's difficult for a Métis or a First Nation woman in today's world to teach that culture to their children? Do you think there's something that holds them back from teaching it, even if they're married to a Caucasian or another race? What would hold them back from being able to impart that knowledge?
You know, I mean, I think for my generation, like I'll be 60 less than tomorrow, there has been a change where I think people really, particularly among First Nations people, with the, for want of a better word, the coming forth and speaking about the residential schools. There have been lawsuits against the residential schools in Canada. We've only had one big one here, which is in my area. But I think, you know, what in my father's generation, I mean, there's such a generation of shame, you know, it was very shameful to be Native. I think some of that is going away. And I think actually, we talked about Ted Nugent, but I think one of the things that's making a huge difference now is social media, where there are so many Native threats, where people are really starting to speak up. So I think it's getting easier in some ways than it was, you know, even 5 years ago. I think that the issue of the Redskin name, which is certainly taking, you know, front and center, where people have been very demeaning about that, people are running up and saying, no, it's not okay. You know, we're not mascots, and it's not okay. And so I think actually there's a shift in the wind in terms of people being willing to speak up about being mixed blood, which, and I'm Métis. My family is Métis, as well as being enrolled here in Washington. So, yeah, that was certainly not something I knew. But I don't know if you're familiar with the Métis in Canada, Anita, where there actually is a group of people that are called Métis, and they're in the eastern part of Canada. They're actually quite strong, and I actually did some work for them about 20 years ago, that group.
My mother's side is Métis. Much everybody that settled in this one particular area, the Frenchmen coming over to New France, awarded the land and everything. But, of course, the only Catholic girls they could marry were, the people of the First Nation. Because,
right.
And, in fact, the church even sent a lot of these women, these young women, to France for a year or two to teach them how to be wives to the Frenchmen. It was almost like a whitewashing of their culture and bringing them back and having them marry into the French culture. It's
interesting that you say that, because my grandmother's name was Tronkian, and she was christened Marguerite Cowlitz, although she wasn't Cowlitz. She was Steinhoff. But she was christened by the Jesuits. Marguerite, and then she married Louis Ladue, which is where my French name, my last name, comes from. But I was not aware that they were sent to France. That's quite interesting. Somehow I'm not surprised.
Yeah, I read that on some old, there's actually an old internet website that goes back into, it's very interesting, but I could sit there and read it for hours, but it goes through all the surnames, all the birth records, all the death records, who came over on the ship, who went back, who came back, who owned what property. It even goes into crimes that were recorded.
That's amazing.
And I'll have to turn you on to that link. It was just quite interesting, and I haven't been able, when I get reading on it and recognizing the names that are in my family tree, I get to the point where I can't really stop reading. I have to keep reading, or something will trigger me to go into another year, you know, like a story that I've read, or to check out another ship and who was on the ship, and it's quite interesting. And only through that website was I able to find out about this traveling back and forth where the women lost their culture, basically.
Were these the Jesuits by any chance?
There was Jesuits that were involved. There was, of course, other Catholics, but at the time, New France was not, it was a religious state. It was Catholic, and there was no other religion permitted in New France. I'm sure there were. I'm sure that there were Huguenots there that probably kept their religion very secret. They say that there were Jewish people there, that, you know, a lot of them were the merchants, but they kept their religion very secret. And, of course, worshiping out in the open was out of the question because it was a religious state, and it was Roman Catholic, and that was that.
But don't you find it so interesting that people came over for religious freedom?
Yeah. Didn't get it.
Nor did they give it.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it was until years later when, you know, other faiths started settling in the area there. I'm talking about on the St. Lawrence River in the Charlevoix area, which is where my family came from, north of Quebec City and very close to Bay St. Paul. So that's where my family's from. But, yeah, it's, you know, there's a lot of history there that I haven't delved into. I've just done bits and pieces. So it would be interesting to find out who and, you know, when, what religions were actually, you know, entering into the villages there and establishing a foothold. But in the beginning, you're definitely right. It was Jesuits for the most part.
Yeah. Well, and that's what it was. And our next was Jesuit Father DeSmet and his crew came with the Hudson Bay Company, which is what I do, employed by the Hudson Bay Company, and then married Marguerite Callett. Although, like I said, she wasn't Callett, she was actually died from. That's really interesting. I'd love to see that website.
I'll have to try to look it up real quick, and if I can, I'll announce it so other people can check it out. But once you get into it and start checking out the archives, it's just some incredible reading. You were comparing kind of like the First Nation experience with what's been happening in Gaza in the Middle East. Can you tell me your impressions on how those would be very similar or could be compared side by side?
Well, you know, that's what I was going to say, is that, you know, part of what I've been following very closely, but I have for years and years, is the whole issue of the Palestinian people. And there was a map, and I'm going to see if I can find it again, where it put the occupation of indigenous land in the United States as we were squeezed into smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller pieces. And it was put up next to a map of Palestine, and where the Palestinian people have been pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed until there's basically nothing left. And just looking at that map and then looking at the rhetoric, and the rhetoric is what I find terrifying, you know, that, you know, we'll kill every single evening kid, maybe it was vermin and everything like that. I mean, and if you look at it in terms of what the U.S. government said about Native people, and the absolute dehumanization as justification for what they're doing in Gaza, if you look at the wording, it's no different than Hitler. It's no different than what the U.S. government did. It's no different than, you know, what the religious people did in terms of forcing Native children into boarding schools. And I find it terrifying. I find it absolutely terrifying because this is a body of people who, of all people, ought to know what Holocaust is, and they're perpetrating their own Holocaust and using the exact same rhetoric on the people in Gaza and the Palestinians as was used on them. And it's just astonishing to me to watch this. What's more troubling to me, though, and you and I talked about this in last time, is the support of the U.S. government for Israel, and they're basically ethnic cleansing and genocide that they're doing. And I find that absolutely horrendous, but it's not surprising because if you look really truthfully at the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, we use the same rhetoric, you know, insurgents rather than freedom fighters, you know, and they're out to get us, and, you know, Saddam Hussein is behind 9/11, and it's all rhetoric, and what people aren't listening to or paying attention to is the history under the rhetoric. And for me, that's incredibly close to what happened with Native people, the names that we were called, the excuses that were used, the justification that was given. And I was reading this book I've been reading, it's called Lewis and Clark Among the Nez Perce, and it talks about the time of contact with Lewis and Clark, and then into the basic eradication and final destruction by General O.O. Howard. By the way, Howard University is named after O.O. Howard. He was a Civil War general who Chief Joseph surrendered to. But I was reading some of the words in the justification and the whole issue of Redskin and where that term came from. And if you look at them side by side by what Netanyahu was saying about the people in Gaza, it's exactly the same thing. And it's horrible. It's horrifying. And
I was shocked at some of the media stories that came out, of course, over the past several weeks. And what I heard and what I was reading about was just blatant, overt. It's ethnic cleansing. It's genocide. It's ecocide. I was watching live feeds at night where I could see the sun coming up and the shelling beginning. There would be like a yellow overcast. The live feed is very blurry at times, but you can see when the sky is clear, and you can also see when it's very overcast or there's a haze. And the sky would be a yellow haze with the backdrop of some of these blown-out buildings, and I thought, oh, my God, they're using depleted uranium. They have to be. So it's not just a question of the people that have died, which, of course, you know, are in the thousands, and the ones that are injured, but this is a systematic ethnic cleansing, extermination of these people. And, depleted uranium, it kills.
I guess my question would be, you know, looking at this whole thing, how is that any different than what we do when we went into Iraq? Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction that they were going to use against us, but we killed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. That doesn't get reported, and nobody blinks about that, and that astonishes me. You know, they're talking about, you know, and Dick Cheney, who I love that he's giving advice on how to do Iraq. That's like, okay, Dick, really? I don't think we need any advice from you. But it was the justification again. And, you know, well, you know, they attacked us. Well, no, Iraq didn't attack us. And rather than people being critical in their thinking, it was all reactive. And I am extremely concerned about the U.S. involvement in supporting what Israel is doing in Gaza, because it's genocide, plain and simple. You know, who's getting killed? And I probably am sticking my neck out here, but I find it very difficult to believe in that they don't know that those are civilian targets. You know, and it's children who are getting killed. And the justification of it is no different than what we saw in Rwanda, no different than what we saw in Kosovo, what was that, 20 years ago? It's the same rhetoric.
Being Air Force intelligence myself, there's absolutely, and the Israelis have the most updated of equipment and, weaponry, because we sell it to them and we give it to them. We give them $3.5 billion a year, and that's not even including the military hardware and armament. So they're using the most high-tech weapons, and all of those weapons have guidance systems. So the fact that they didn't know they were hitting a civilian target, they didn't know they were hitting a target that was not authorized by the Geneva Convention, is a big BS story. They were openly hitting first responders, paramedics, hospitals, schools. All these targets are they're not considered targets. They're considered protected areas.
But I would ask, honestly, my brother worked for Raytheon, and he developed missile guidance systems. That's what he did for 30 years. Well, and he and I have a little bit different view of the world in terms of where I think resources should go. But you know, one of the concerns I have, and you were talking about how is what's going on in Gaza very similar to what happened with First Nations and Native people. And if you look, what was it, 1947, is that when Israel was declared a state? I can't remember if it's 46 or 47.
And 48.
Like 48.
Yeah, both of those years, you know, was involved. And those were the big years where people emigrated. So I would
There's a film, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's, I have to get to the name. It's a very good film, and it's basically on American Jewish people and who escaped the Holocaust and their families who didn't escape the Holocaust, having these schools for children in Israel, Jewish children, to reinforce their hatred of the Palestinians and the Arab world. And it reminds me very much of the Bible camp that we have in this country that are just pure indoctrination with no common sense, no critical thinking. And, you know, and when you have something like that, and certainly as a Native American woman and what I deal with every single day, one of my friends went out, had too much to drink last night, and I got an email from him saying he had too much fire water. Like, okay, he had too much fire water. I mean, but it's the language that's being used now, and it's the language that's used to dehumanize. And I just want to walk you through the generations of it up to what we're doing right now in Gaza. World War II, it was Japs, and that was the term that was used to intern the Japanese here in this country for justification. Yellow men. Japs. And then we had, in Vietnam, we had gooks, which is a term I just absolutely despise. Very dehumanizing. And then we get to Ronald Reagan, not one of my favorite people. I always thought he was senile when he was in office, and I think a lot of us did and were proven right. But, you know, we have the evil empire, and then we have Cheney come in and his axis of evil. And what it does, if you think about it, I mean, it takes the focus off of what really is going on in terms of corporations and, you know, the world. And when I look at this whole thing with Israel, if you listen to the language, how they're describing the people of God, the nation that I've talked about from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, you know, all the way up to Iraq I and Iraq II and Afghanistan. And that's what's very concerning to me, because it was that language that allowed the U.S. government to exterminate my people, the names that we were called. And
wow.
The reason I want to talk about Ted Nugent for just a second, Anita, and I really need to do this as much as I hate to give the man any airtime because I think he's just a buffoon, is the arrogance that he shows. And he is a colonizer in his attitude. You know, he wears our headdresses. He's not a warrior. The man actually got a 4F deferment by pooping and urinating in his pants for a month before he went in for his physical. And this is who the writer holding up as a hero. Are you kidding me? But if you listen to the language, I mean, I'm from the Northwest. I'm from a Northwest tribe here, and I know people from Coeur d'Alene. I went to school with people from Coeur d'Alene. I know the people up there at Plummer, you know, and I know people from the Spokane Reservation and the Colville Reservation. You know, and I worked for the Puyallup tribe. In fact, my auntie sat as the Puyallup tribal judge. Puyallup was one of the tribes that said, we don't want you on our reservation. We don't want you at our casinos. And so who he's calling unclean vermin is basically me. And, you know, if you think of those words, they're horrible. They're ugly, ugly words. And the backlash against those of us who are speaking up against Ted Nugent is quite interesting. And I don't know, I mean, if you follow the Redskin name with Dan Snyder's original American Foundation, as if we couldn't see through that, you know, like they're going to give us, you know, beats for Manhattan again. Are you following any of that?
No. Fill me in. I would love to hear about that.
There's an organization, Women for Redskins, and one of the things that I always find very interesting, and it's very much about the scouts who work for the U.S. Cavalry, is you can always find Native people who will say, oh, yeah, I'm in favor of the Redskins. That's fine with me. But Redskins in case you didn't know, was a term that was used to describe the scalps and the skins of Native people who were paid for bounty. So it's not an honorable name, but there's a website out on, I'll have to get it for you on Facebook, that is, you know, save our names because it's a tradition of honor. And in fact, it's completely false. There's no honor in the term redskin at all. You know, it's a horrendously awful term. But, you know, we have
a squaw.
That's another term I object to. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very derogatory term. Why would anybody say that word? You know, a First Nation Native American woman, a squaw. It's horrible, horrible.
Well, but, you know, Anita, but again, we're back to the issue of language. And for me, as I've watched this whole thing in Gaza, there's been several aspects to me which are very similar to not just what was going on in Native communities, but what's going on in Native communities against Native people today. What I want to know is why isn't the majority of Americans standing up and saying to Ted Nugent, are you crazy? He has a huge following. He has a huge following of people who, you know, think, oh, poor Teddy. You know, Teddy's the hero of the right because he's a gun rights. It's like, Teddy was no hero. You know, he's a coward. He is a coward. He's not Native. We don't claim him as ours. He's not a friend to us. He misappropriates our headdresses and mocks us. He's not a friend at all. But if you think about that, you know, I mean, it's the same thing, which is, you know, it's what I call the missionary attitude is, I'm going to save you. Well, every time a missionary goes out to save a Native person, you know, we all die. That's the savior there. But I think if you listen to the rhetoric coming out of the U.S. Congress regarding Israel, it's very demonizing of Palestinians. And that's what people are not listening to, that they are justifying giving millions more in weaponry and support to people who are basically humanizing the Palestinians, children, women, men. And I think what Netanyahu said, that we were going to have to settle in for a long war in Gaza, I think that was one of his most recent statements, if I recall correctly. And if you think about what does that mean, you know, we're going to settle in for a long war on Gaza. What does that say to you? It means get ready to eradicate everybody we possibly can. That's what that says.
Yeah, their targeting of these facilities that were not supposed to be targets were designed to maim and to take out as many people as possible, including women and children, which is even more dehumanizing and demoralizing. Just, you know, and people don't know this. Half of the population of Palestine, is 50% of them, are children under 18.
Are they under 18? And are they 15? I was trying to remember. I was looking for that number right before I called you to see.
Yeah,
I know.
Are under 18. So the majority of the people there did not vote for Hamas. You know, Hamas was supposed to be democratically elected, but, you know, I tried to explain this to a friend just earlier. You know, Hamas is acting like our government is acting. Our government is acting like the evil empire and going into every country and killing people. And we don't agree with it. We here in the peace community, in fact, most Americans, even with the financial situation we're in, do not agree with what's going on and the money being spent and the people being killed. So
I would ask you, you know, I don't disagree with that, except I would ask you one thing. How many Americans actually are cognizant enough, you know, they're everybody, you know, trying to pay their bills. How many people are really even cognizant of the amount of money you're talking about? It's horrendous amount of money that goes for weaponry and, you know.
I think so many people here in the United States are so wrapped up in just the survival of everyday life that they can't, and they're afraid to rise up. They're afraid they're going to lose their jobs, or they're working three jobs, or they're, you know, and they can't get out, or they don't have gas for the car. it's hard to rise up and create movements when you don't have the money or you don't have the time or you're just trying to feed your family. And I think
I think that's deliberate, though. And I think crushing the middle class, breaking the unions, crushing the middle class, the whole inflation of fuel prices, there's no reason for gas to be the cost it is. And
right.
I think there's pockets of people who are paying attention, but I think most people, as you say, you know, are very afraid for their jobs. I mean, I look at the situation that happens with Walmart all the time, and people are really scared, and the whole thing, are they going to have health care and all this stuff. But I guess my point in all this is that what people are paying attention to, and it's very worrisome to me, they didn't pay attention to Iraq, they didn't pay attention to Afghanistan. What they're not paying attention to is the rhetoric and the justification. This is not about Hamas. Hamas is, whatever your thoughts about Hamas, this is not about Hamas. They killed Hamas 20 times over if they hit the number of people that they said. You know, it's my feeling about it is they're just trying to pummel the Gaza Strip into nothing so that they can move into settlements in that area. That's my take.
Well, the other thing is there's gas and oil reserves right off of the coast, and that's why they are no longer allowed to fish in those waters. But there is a huge gas and oil reserve there, and it's a big, huge operation at this point because they already have exploratory drilled there. So, and this is one of the reasons why so many of these ships that were bringing in aid to Gaza were either escorted away, and some of them were actually, some of the ships were actually boarded by the IDF and the people on the ships. And on one occasion, it was the Spirit of Humanity. They were all taken to jail in Israel. In Central That was back in, I believe it was 2009. And what they wanted to do was, bust through the siege and bring the, and this was Free Gaza and a whole bunch of other groups. There was a Nobel Peace Poet Laureate aboard, the former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, who had run for president on the Green Party ticket, she was aboard. They were all taken to jail and spent a week in jail in an Israeli prison. So there's a reason why those waters, which are supposed to be international waters, why they're keeping them on lockdown and not allowing the ships to go through. So,
does anyone, where is that out in the media that that's even being talked about?
If you put in oil and gas reserves off the coast of Gaza, you'll pull up some items. I think The Guardian did a few things, Global Research.
The Guardian's pretty good about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they came out with some things. They actually had some maps, and just recently there's probably been four or five really good articles, but what the oil companies do is pretty open, and if you can put mapping of oil and gas reserves off the coast of Gaza in a Google search, you'll pull up information. And, most of the information that's on the oil companies, they'll flat out write what they're doing, what they're drilling, what and where they're drilling.
Is Halliburton involved in that?
Pardon?
Is Halliburton involved in that?
Oh, I'm sure it's Halliburton, but there's probably so many other companies are involved in the extraction business. It's hard to pinpoint one or two, and they all work together. So, I don't know if the United States is involved in regard. If we probably are, if you would consider companies that are multinational, which most of the oil companies are.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But, again,
a big reason why this whole thing happened. I'm very sure of it. So,
I said for years that the biggest issue, I started saying this in the 1980s and wrote about it, the biggest issue in Indian country is the fact that 50% of all the undeveloped energy resources in this country sit under Indian land. I call it the oops phenomena. They gave us the worst land, nothing would grow, and what was underneath it? Resources.
Yeah, natural resources.
Natural resources. And that's been a huge issue coming up now in, you know, terms of policy, Native American policy. I don't know if you're following the Cobell settlements or not, which still have not been paid out for mismanagement of Native resources by the BIA.
So as you know,
they ordered a whopping $3 billion for 155 years worth of mismanagement. You know, I won't even get started on that. I don't even think the checks have come out for that yet. But, you know, I mean, I think it's, again, what people don't think about is this country was founded on genocide, environmental destruction, exploitation of resources. Those three things. And it's always about always follow the money. So when people say, oh, we fought, you know, in Iraq for, you know, this country, it's like, no, we didn't. We fought for Halliburton, Bechtel, Boeing, General Motors.
Yeah, it was all corporate. All of it was corporate.
I can't help believe, and that's part of what's going on, you know, in Gaza, that there's, you know, the rhetoric. I don't know if you followed the rhetoric the run up to the, you know, Iraqi invasion, but it was, you know, these people are out to get us. You know, 3,000 people died in the towers, and as a Native person, I think, and 100 million people died, you know, on this continent. And my people used to number 22,000. There's 3,800 of us now. It's like, yeah, so what? 3,000 people died. Yeah, it was awful and horrible. But you have to pay attention to the rhetoric, because always underneath the rhetoric, is the true mission, which is to demonize people so that you can go in and take their homes and kill them and take their resources and not feel bad about it. That's always the point of the rhetoric. And that's very similar to what went on in Indian country. You know, the only good Indian was a dead Indian. And I don't know if you knew who said that, but it was Teddy Roosevelt, who sits up on Mount Rushmore. Abraham Lincoln ordered the biggest mass execution in this country of, I think it was 36 Santee Sioux men to bring this, you know, the Sioux Nation to their knees. He's on Mount Rushmore. You know, George Washington and Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence talks about how, you know, we have the noble savages that they have to kill, and the king isn't helping them kill the Native people. And so we have this mythology of these people sitting up on Mount Rushmore, and that's the mythology that Netanyahu and his career, and it's a mythology. I mean, as they're saying about, you know, we're the noble race and, you know, we're the master race. And when I heard him say that about, you know, God's chosen people, all I could think of was Hitler saying we are the master race. And you think, my Lord, we're two generations away from that, and this is the best we can do. It's horrifying.
Right. Yeah, I agree. It's like a repeat of what's gone on before. And I have to wonder, I've sat here and thought about this over and over again. These are the same people that were tortured, that were gassed, that had all kinds of dehumanizing things happen to them in, you know, Europe in the 1930s and 1940s. Yet they get the reparations, which is the land. They go back to the land that, you know, the international community has guaranteed that can be their homeland. And they carry out the same procedures on the people that are there. The same thing. It's like the same playbook. And I go, why? Well, I don't get it. I don't understand. So that freaks me out when I think about how that's carried through to these generations. Where do you think we go from here? What do we, as an American people, I have some ideas, but what do you think about where we should be and what we should do to bring peace in the Middle East and in our own backyard?
Well, yeah, I think we need to start in our own backyard, and one of the things we need to do is we need to start getting honest about who's running this country. And one of the things I'm going to stick my neck out again and say, this Supreme Court is the worst Supreme Court ever in terms of taking away personal rights, including the corporations. Just horrendous. Citizens United and the Hobby Lobby decision. You know, it's like we've dehumanized people and humanized corporations. And I think until people, and I'm going to just be really blunt here, Dave Reichert's my congressman, and he is the worst congressman in Congress. I don't think he's ever put forth a piece of legislation. And when we had the sequester, you know, back in January, I called his office to ask where he stood. His office said to me, we don't know where the congressman stands on positions like that. We're not privy to his private thoughts. And I said, please tell me that as a constituent, you're not telling me that I'm not allowed to think to know how my congressman is thinking about this. And I think that, we have to really take our individual responsibility in voting people out. Who, if I'm going to be working against Wright, get him out. Congressman's opinion on, you know, what is he going to do to get the government going again? There's something wrong with that. And I think
somebody told me that just recently about a local guy that's running here, and he was asked about his take. This was just very, very localized, but he was asked on his take on local mining. And there's a group here that's trying to stop the mining that's happening in this county. And it's an international company. It's a company from another country that's come in and they're mining here. So this guy's running for county commissioner. So somebody went up and asked him, and he said, well, if I make a statement about that or I sign your petition, then later on if this comes up, I have to recuse myself. And I said, when do you have to recuse yourself, and since when do you not allow your constituents know your stand on the issues? When did that happen?
Well, it's happened with Dave Reichert here, and I'm going to say it again, Dave Reichert. The other person that we have that I'm very worried about running is a guy named Clint Didier, who is a former Redskin, who when I complained about it, I was told I was a slave. Like, and my response was, that's the stupidest response I've ever heard. But you know, and I want to just draw some parallels here in terms of you asked a really good question. How do we get peace? Go back to the Clinton years. What was happening then? We had Al-Qaeda going on, and then we had the bombings in, was it Dar es Salaam and, where were they? And they were in Tanzania and Kenya.
And we had Kosovo, Serbia.
Right, and we had all that going on. Yeah.
Right.
How do we get peace? We change human nature. You know, I don't know. I think as long as we have the rhetoric that I'm talking about, we're always going to have war, because you're always going to have we versus them. In fact, I wrote an article. I'm trying to think when it was. Probably 20 years ago. We versus them phenomenon, which is that every group has a we and every group has a them. I don't know, have you ever read Wright's book, The Once and Future King? Have you ever had the chance to read? Yeah. The first book, I think it's an incredible book, and anybody who hasn't read it needs to read it. It's an amazing book. But in there, you know, Merlin teaches Arthur by turning him to animals and insects. And do you remember he goes to war with the ants, and the ants don't have very good vocabulary. They have done and not done. If something is done, ants in their brain, mammy, mammy, mammy song that they have to sing all day long. And, you know, the big ants send them off to war, and for no reason, and the little ants just go. And I think it's one of the best analogies of how masses are handled by propaganda. And there was an interesting thing put up by a group of Christians, I don't remember what city it was in, about he who controls the youth controls the country, and it was an Adolf Hitler quote. And someone finally said to them, do you know that you're quoting Adolf Hitler? And it was this ad to get people to, you know, to send their kids in this camp. I think really what you do is you have to have people challenge the rhetoric. You know, you have to have people come out and say, no, this is not okay. And that takes courage to do that. I mean, because I was one of the people who was absolutely adamantly opposed to the Iraqi war. I knew it was a bunch of garbage, that there, you know, it was completely fabricated. And I had people quit talking to me. I had people tell me that I was un-American. That was one of my favorites. It's like, I'm un-American. Okay, great. You know, I speak up and say, you know, we need to not take our country to this, you know, morass. And I was called that in America. So, well, call me un-American. I don't care. But you have to be willing to stand up against the rhetoric. And I think that the only way we're going to get peace is, one, to stand up against the rhetoric and say, no, we're not going to dehumanize people. And two, to really start challenging people in power. You know, like, I won't even call my congressman who's worthless, you know, to say, you know, hold them accountable. And I'll tell you, people that are scaring me, and in a very, very badly, are people like Michelle Bachmann and some of her rhetoric. And she got put back in office again. I hope to God she doesn't this time. You know, Ted Cruz, look at his rhetoric. Rand Paul, you know, they're disciples of Anne Rand, but people don't really understand what that means, to be a disciple of hers. I think we just have to speak up, all of us. You know, anybody, you know, who disagrees, and whether it's on social media or whether it's in private conversation, you just have to speak up. I had an interesting thing happen on the street where I live. It's a very tiny street in outside, up in the mountains, away from a very tiny town. And when I moved onto the block, I integrated the block because I'm mixed race and I was Democrat, registered Democrat. Not that I have much use for Democrats, I don't, but in Washington you either register as Republican or Democrat. And my family had allotments on the Yakima Reservation. They were sold years and years ago, but there are still Kalix people who are allotted onto Yakima, which is maybe an hour south east of me. So he was running for county commissioner. And one of the overriding governing things in Kittitas County, Yakima County, where I live, Kittitas County, are treaty rights that the Yakimas have to keep the rivers at a certain flow to keep the salmon going.
Right.
And so it's created huge bitterness. And I have brown hair and green eyes. It's called genetics. And I am Native. And so my neighbor Steve, who was running for county commissioner, there was a water moratorium here in Kittitas County for a while, was just cussing the Yakima Indians up one side and down the other. I mean, I don't even want to repeat some of the things that he was saying. And I finally, after listening to this, for half an hour, I spoke up and I said, you know, Steve, I'm related to those people that you're cussing up one side and down the other. And the conversation just went, as you can imagine, there were several neighbors there, just went dead. And I still didn't know what to do. I mean, it was just really, it was like, excuse me, but, you know, that's me you're talking about there. And it was just, the silence was deafening. And you could see people kind of like, oh, we thought she was one of us. And that's that us versus them mentality. But Anita, you know and I know, every single war is economically based. You can cover it with holy rhetoric. You can say, oh, they were going to bomb us, oh, they were out to get us, oh, they were behind 9/11, blah, 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 blah. But the bottom line to every war is greed and economics.
Right.
You follow the money. I don't care what you want to label it, the greatest generation, I don't care what you want to label it, all wars are economically driven, every single one of them.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Let me ask you this. We've got just a few more minutes, but just some parting thoughts on what we should do. Now, I've been talking to people about BDS, which is and urging people to go to the website, bdsmovement.net.
Mm-hmm.
Explains how to do that. In other words, any Zionist Israel company or product, you just don't buy it. You just don't give them your money. The chokehold and the changes will result from them not getting the money.
I think that's exactly right. And like I said, it's all economics. I mean, you know, you remember when I don't know what year you were in high school, what you're doing, but the whole Western history, United States history, in terms of what was considered about Native, was under the heading Manifest Destiny. Do you remember that term?
Yes, I do.
Manifest Destiny. That we had a God-given right to wipe out you Indians. And David Barton, by the way, a crazy Christian preacher, by the way, still preaches that stuff. Garbage, you know, that we were terrorists, that's why they had the right to eradicate us. But
right.
If you listen to that, Manifest Destiny was about the acquisition of resources in this land.
Right.
and moving westward, and westward expansionism, that's what it was.
Manifest destiny, westward hope.
Right. And I wonder, now, do they still teach it, or is that class been removed?
Oh, no, they still teach it. They still teach it, particularly in Texas.
Yeah, from what I understand, not people are getting their history anymore. So,
well, again, and if you look at the rhetoric and how this is all being pushed, it's the manifest destiny of the Jewish people to take over that land of Israel and Palestine. Listen to the rhetoric. It's exactly the same mentality, manifest destiny.
Wow.
And a lot of people have not thought about that. When I listen to it, it's like, oh, I know, this is way too familiar to me. I know this story inside and out. And
well, they don't want you to have much to take in Gaza. I mean, they have quite a lot more to take in the West Bank, which they've been very successful at because they've just had the Israeli, the Israelis move in and just start settlements on Palestinian land. And they are definitely sucking up the land that has anything to do with the aquifer there, so they have control of the water. So that's a big, big issue in the West Bank. But in Gaza...
Well, that's a big issue in the world.
Yeah,
who's going to control water resources.
Gaza's 24 miles long and 4 miles wide. There's not much to take, but they certainly have that water, that West Coast, locked down, and it's because of those oil reserves and natural gas reserves that are there. But
well,
we're coming to a close.
Okay.
And I just, Robin, I just want to thank you for your wisdom and for being on the show, and we're definitely going to have you come back, but give us some information on where people can find you and on the net and how they can get in touch with you.
Well, my book, which is called Totems of September, we talked about in April, and I'm amazed, Anita, how prescient it is, because one of the themes of the book is how 9/11 was used for the very thing that we're talking about now. But it was written from a Native American viewpoint. So our website is septembertotems.com.
Good.
And that's a good way to get a hold of me.
I'll put a link underneath the blog post with that on there. And just very short before we disconnect, I have that website for you, and I'll also send it to you. But for anybody else that's listening that's interested in Métis history in Quebec, in New France, the website's www.métis-history.info. And there's just click on the links, and it'll take you right into the history and all the recorded information. It's definitely what archived, from the Catholic churches is how I think they acquired a lot of this. So,
well, I would like to say one last thing, which is people don't be afraid to speak up. What's the worst thing that can happen?
Yeah, and I think that's the important message here is we have to stand up and counter the rhetoric. We have to debunk the rhetoric that's coming at us from all sides. I think that's really, really important. So thank you again, Robin, and we'll have a
my pleasure.
And you have a great, be careful and, keep us posted about that fire out there. So,
all right. Have a good evening, Anita. Thank you so much.
And you too. Bye-bye.
Good night.
So that was our interview with Robin Ledoux, and I still have not heard from her in regards to the fire, so I'm hoping she didn't evacuate. Catch us next week, same time, same place, 10 o'clock, wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com is where you can find us on the net, and I'll close with this song called Mashael. It's a Palestinian song. And this show is dedicated to the Palestinians and the brave people of Gaza. Have a good night.